The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Caron, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Evaluation of the postoperative febrile patient is presented by Dr. Marc-Alain Durie.
Today we're going to talk briefly about the evaluation of fever in the postoperative patient. I have nothing to disclose. My objectives here, at the conclusion of this section, participants will be able to comprehend. Probably the most important thing here is that fevers after an operative procedure can be related to the actual operative procedure itself, i.e. tissue trauma and inflammation. And so if I were to take one take-home point here, is not every fever postoperatively is secondary to an infectious cause. It could just necessarily be inflammation. And the first set of slides will show that fairly clearly. We'll identify the common medications that produce fever. Here's a hint, they're antibiotics. Those are my love affair drugs right there, and so sometimes I actually have to flip them around. Understand the temporal relationship to fever and the operative procedure, so sometimes the clues as to the time of and how far away we are from the operative procedure will help us, and identify common sources for fever in relationship to the procedure itself. Should be no surprise that in abdominal surgeries, doing CT scans to help find abscesses for secondary peritonitis are oftentimes helpful. So with that as the context, let's talk very quickly about the pathophysiology. And the first couple slides here are really just kind of reminding us that the process of fever is a natural process. Without the setting of a bacterial stimuli, interleukins, chemokines, cytokines, prostaglandins all, in essence, produce fever. And without the stimulus of a endo or exotoxin or direct bacterial injury, interleukin-6 is the cytokine that most closely corresponds to fever, but in this case, particularly post-op fever. And here's a set of slides graphs, rather. The bottom graph is just looking at body temperature status post a CABG, and the top is looking at the same set of patients, but with looking at their interleukin-6, and you could see a very similar pattern. And based on these data here, and in this particular paper, I think most people would agree at this point that the association of fever and interleukin-6 levels suggests mostly an inflammatory response. And so this kind of is also further reinforced with the study here, and when we look at the actual tissue damage that occurs with the actual procedure that gets done. So when you are looking here at this study, when you're looking at CABG patients that were either on or off pump, those that were off pump had significant fewer elevations of body temperature, also then suggesting that cytokines are released by the amount of tissue damage that gets done. So if I were to summarize here, not all fevers are infectious. And just like we always hear that not all that wheezes is asthma, not every fever that you see post-operative is considered an infectious etiology. And I think that is probably my biggest take-home point of this lecture. So let's look at some of these other potential sources of fever. With respect to timing, when you look at the various sources of timing, we're going to focus on the first two, which is immediate, which is the onset of fever that occurs in the operating suite or within hours after the surgery, and acute, which occurs within the first week of surgery. We'll look briefly at subacute. In the subacute, really, you're looking at mostly C. diff-associated diarrhea, and then delayed is really, this is where an infectious diseases physician As a generalist or hospitalist, most folks would not be involved with that. You're looking at mostly transplant, post-transplant surgery patients, and in this, we only have 30 minutes here, so I didn't focus that much on the delayed cause or etiology for post-operative fevers. So again, looking at the immediate, the way we'll break this down is looking at medications and drug fever, looking at transfusions and their relationship to fevers post-operatively, looking at trauma that suffered during surgery, and then ultimately infections that were present prior to surgery, and we'll look at a couple case studies as well. So, do you think we could, can you advance? There we go. So, post-operative fevers, one of the most common causes of fevers that is not infectious, unfortunately, are my beloved antibiotics, and in particular, my beloved beta-lactam antibiotics are a large cause. So what you see in red there are different antibiotics and some meds, some of the anti-epileptics as well, will cause drug fevers as well. But some of the medications in the red on the very top section there, again, most of the beta-lactams. And if I'm working up somebody with a fever, either being post-operative or just a fever workup on consult service, first things that I do is I look at beta-lactams. Now, I usually start patients on beta-lactam antibiotics. I'm somewhat resistant to pull them off of it. But if I can't find the source of a fever, or just by looking at the patient, I can tell that there's no infectious cause for that fever, sometimes I'll do a little bit of an antibiotic dance and flip them off. Some of the anti-epileptics and anticonvulsants are obviously a major contributor for some of the hypersensitivity reactions that we see as well. I'm gonna divert just for a quick second out of the post-operative fever classification, just really to talk about some hypersensitivity reactions that are the cause of fever, not necessarily postoperatively, but just the cause of fever itself. I'd be remiss to not talk about somebody that I saw in the hospital service about a week ago. There's an antiretroviral HIV medication called dabacavir, also known as Zyogen. It's been recently co-formulated into a single tablet regimen called Triumeq, three drugs into one pill. And that's part of the single tablet regimens that we've been seeing. The abacavir hypersensitivity reaction can be induced in people who are missing an allele, an HLA allele called HLA-B5701. It's fairly standard of practice right now to check that allele on for every HIV physician. It's part of their intake panel. So we don't really see a bunch of hypersensitivity reactions anymore. But I did see one last week in the hospital, and I thought it was fair just to kind of put it up and just make sure that it was on people's radars. This was a patient who was started on Triumeq at an outside hospital in Atlanta. We were unable to get his records and came in with fever and rash, and we were able to attribute it to abacavir. Some of the most feared, however, consequences of some of the anti-epileptics that we use, of course, is that spectrum of cutaneous eruptions that on one end are TEN, on the other, Stevens-Johnson syndrome as well. And again, these are medication oftentimes induced. And then one that I see a couple times a year that I just wanted to bring to people's attentions was the drug reaction with eosinophilia systemic symptoms called Dress syndrome, used to be called the phenytoin hypersensitivity syndrome as well, giving rise or paying homage to the medication that would actually cause this cutaneous eruption. This could be a life-threatening disease. Oftentimes when I'm working up a fever, and I don't understand, and there's a fairly impressive rash, I will sometimes get fooled to thinking that the skin manifestations are actually causing the fever, and then at one point, when I'm just staring at labs, all of a sudden that eosinophilia will just jump out at me, and then that's what usually gives me my clue that what we're looking at is actually Dress syndrome. So jumping back into the postoperative fever, one of the hypersensitivity reactions that you would see immediately after an operative procedure is something called the malignant hyperthermia. That's as a result of muscle depolarizing agents such as Sux or inhaled anesthetic agents such as halothane. It's important to identify. Certainly our surgical colleagues and anesthesiologists can identify this fairly quickly, and life-saving medication in the form of dantrolene can be given. I was called last week to evaluate somebody for fever, and it took me all of 5 minutes to recognize that he'd had a transfusion the night before. Nobody put the two and two together. So blood transfusions and fever obviously go hand in hand as well. And then looking at infections that were present prior to surgery, here I had an elderly female from an LTAC long-term care facility in New Orleans. In late January, presented with abdominal pain and rigors. Workup in the ER revealed a cholangitis resulting in an urgent cholecystectomy. Her labs and physical exam ultimately settled down, but her fevers persisted. I rearranged her antibiotics thinking that this was a beta-lactam-induced fever, but her fever persisted on post-op day 3. I had one of my fellows call the nursing home and ask them one question, and that one question was, is there any influenza at that nursing home? The answer was yes, and so we tested her for rapid flu, and she was positive. So be thinking about and think out of the box as to what could be causing a flu fevers outside of what you would typically see. So case study here, 58-year-old man hospitalized for an elective bilateral total knee. And he's well controlled with hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and osteoarthritis. The day after surgery, he's feeling well except for some knee pain controlled by pain medication. He's started on cefazolin for prophylaxis. His physical exam is normal except for some serous sanguineous drainage from his right knee. Vital signs shows a fever. His laboratory results shows a white blood cell count of 11,000. Which of the following would you do? A blood, UA, and urine cultures, add a radiography, add vancomycin, or observation only. And again, the point here is that most post-operative fevers that occur within 48 hours after surgery, you could just really mostly observe that the majority of the stuff is as a result of either tissue damage or inflammation, which is more or less the same thing, very likely caused by IL-6. So, going to the acute. So this is where infections actually really happen. And this is, initially I tried to do this lecture without going over the 5 W's, but I realized I couldn't get away from it. It actually works as a very nice mnemonic. I actually still use it to this day. So, but this is where we see the pneumonias, because this is the stuff where we stick stuff in people, right? So we stick tubes down people's throats, we give them pneumonias, we stick catheters in their GU, we get UTIs, we have catheters into their vascular system, we have cavities or CLABSIs, and then of course the actual site of surgery. So this is where we actually do see some infectious complications. But one thing I do want to bring to your attention is, and answer the question, and hopefully answer the question once and for all, does atelectasis cause fever? The answer is no. Atelectasis does not cause fever. I'm still stunned when medical students at my institution at Tulane still come to me with that as part of a differential diagnosis. This was a meta-analysis, about 5 or 6 studies looking to see if there was any cause of fever from atelectasis. I think that squarely is no. There's just no way that inflammation is caused by collapsed alveoli. There's no interleukins or cytokines that's released as a result of that. So you can see there, I just crossed out atelectasis and still will hold on to some of those other elements of the postoperative fever. So again, still a helpful mnemonic. This morning, my colleague and friend and former mentor, Dr. J.D. Polk, spoke. Before J.D. went to NASA, we used to fly together at Cleveland Metro Life Flight. I was a flight physician, a trauma doctor for 10 years before I went into ID. And one of the things that I learned from the HEMS pilots, the helicopter EMS pilots, was this whole concept of crew resource management. It was this idea that helicopters were falling out of the skies, and before that it was commercial airlines, and before that it was aircraft that was in Vietnam. And what the airline and pilots did was they pulled together this whole concept of checklist. And that whole concept of checklist called crew resource management has filtered its way into medicine, and I think in a way that just seemed like a very obvious marriage in the form of now bundles. So we don't see the, fortunately, the dramatic crashes that once plagued the health EMS or the helicopter EMS folks anymore, fortunately, largely due to this crew resource management. We now see that iteration of it in the form of bundles. I'm a huge fan of bundles. I think bundles work great. And so when we're going to talk about now about these postoperative fevers, I'm going to just do it in the setting of showing the efficacy of bundles. So here is a VAP, HCAP, HAP bundle that was recently done, looking at the efficacy of a VAP bundle. And any of these HAP, HCAP, or VAP bundles really include mostly probably the most important thing, which is keeping everybody up at 35 or 40%, right? And that by itself will significantly decrease the likelihood of any aspiration event. And then, of course, any oral, oral hygiene that occurs as well. So the bundles are very important, and they also significantly help us to decrease the likelihood of postoperative infections. A couple of my own personal notes is, just like I said, not every wheeze is asthma, and not every fever is an infectious etiology. Not every infiltrate is a pneumonia. And so a few times a year I get called, and I literally just got this call on Thursday to go see a guy in the hospital, recently extubated from the ICU, was being treated for an endocarditis. I was following him previously for that. They asked me to come back and see him because he now had a pneumonia, and when I went to go see him, he'd been extubated. He was extubated that day, and the quote-unquote pneumonia that was seen was on the post-extubation film. It's just impossible to be extubated and then also have a pneumonia at the same time. So again, just because you see an infiltrate and the radiologist says that there could be pneumonia, every radiologist always says one thing, you know, right? Clinical correlation indicated, right? So that clinical correlation is us, all right? So please look at your RN notes when you're making a diagnosis of pneumonia. See if there's been increase in cough, because every diagnosis of a HAP, VAP, HCAP will come with some measurable change in your patient. They may be requiring increased PEEP needs or O2 needs, or maybe more sputum production. Talk to the respiratory therapist, look at their notes and see what they have to say, because more often than not, you'll find, if you're looking for it, evidence that there has been a change. Otherwise, that infiltrate that you see without any changes in their PaO2 is just really just an infiltrate and probably not resembling a pneumonia. Not every aspiration is a pneumonia. Every aspiration is an aspiration pneumonitis, so please recognize that as well. And sputum that has yeast in it is just really thrush, right? Candida doesn't really affect the alter the tissue homeostasis of alveoli. You do see fungal infections in very severely immunosuppressed folks in the chest. But otherwise, if you're on a med-surg unit and somebody coughs up a little bit of sputum that's got yeast in it, it reflects the rush more than anything else. So moving on to surgical site infections, of which, of course, we see plenty of those. These are mostly gram-positive organisms as well as gram-negatives. In this study here, this was looking at a bundle in which a preoperative shower, hair was clipped, body temperature was managed and kept within quote-unquote normal ranges, as well as antibiotic prophylaxis in the form of cefazolin was given. And in this case here, they were looking at colorectal surgery, and the use of surgical bundles seemed to reduce significantly the rates of surgical site infections. Mia this morning gave an excellent lecture on sepsis, and one thing that she kept saying over and over again was, look at your patient, look at your patient, look at your patient, look at your wounds, look at your wounds, look at your wounds. I know they're dressed and they look very pretty, and sometimes I'll take the blankets down and all of a sudden I see that they're wearing this like very elaborate girdle-like thing. Right? You got to take them off. You know, and if people get upset with you, you know, that's it. One of the nice things I have recognized is that we do see the use of these, right, in the form of pictures that make their way into EMRs. So those are very nice as well. But it's really incumbent upon us to look at those wounds. Please interpret your wound swabs cautiously, and certainly call ID for that. There are some things that make sense and some things that don't. Surgeons are very good with going in and IND-ing their surgical wounds when they are infected. Please remind them to get intraoperative cultures. And again, also, you're looking at mostly gram-positive cocci as well as gram-negative rods. And when you're dosing your antibiotics, you need lower doses when you're dealing with skin soft tissue infections. When we here are looking at, this is cavities, catheter-associated UTIs. This was a study, this was a national study, looking to reduce catheter use and catheter-associated UTIs in non-ICUs. And it's hard for me to read the slide from here, but I think what we see here is that there was the UTI bundle and the cavity bundle was very effective in multiple different sites in various hospitals with respect to decreasing the likelihood. So again, these bundles are very successful. A couple of my personal pearls of wisdom is please never get a urine culture without a UA. You would never get a lateral chest film without getting that PA. As well. So the UA tells you if there's any white cells, and that gives you the indication if there's an infection or not. Also lets you know if there's any squamous epithelial cells. If you have a UA with lots of squamous epithelial cells, you know that you have a contaminated sample. You have to start again. Don't take seriously that culture that grows from a contaminated a specimen. So again, the UA tells you if there's an infection. The culture itself tells you what that infection is. If you have a urine culture that grows an organism with a completely normal UA or without any white cells, what you have is sterile pyuria, so you don't have an infection. A yeast itself colonizes the urethral tract, so please don't treat a yeast UTI. I've probably treated maybe twice in my lifetime, and they were both in individuals that were profoundly immunosuppressed from having their bone marrow transplanted, and even that I was still doubtful. The last time I treated this was about 3 months ago, and I handed it off to my colleague who laughed at me for treating it. So yeast in the urine doesn't really exist. There's no such thing as a yeast UTI. Change your catheters, and please use condom catheters if possible or if appropriate. I like to change my catheters early and often. Today is voting day in New Orleans. We have a saying in New Orleans, please vote early and often. So I like to say that about our catheters. Please change your catheters early and often. And we're looking mostly at gram-negative rods, use antibiotics that pass through the kidney as well. And you say, well, Dr. Derry, how do you know if an antibiotic passes through the kidney or not? And I say to you, if you have to adjust the dose for creatinine clearance, it's a pretty good bet that your antibiotic is gonna pass through the kidneys. If you're not adjusting for creatinine clearance, like linazolid, it gets filtered through the liver. So oftentimes I like to treat a VRE UTI with daptomycin because, of course, daptomycin, you have to adjust for creatinine clearance, and it actually clears through the urine. Linazolid clears through the urine 70% through the liver. And lastly, this was the study that kind of started it all. I did some of my training at Michigan State University with the great Dr. Gary Roth, which a cardiothoracic surgeon, which actually got I hold him responsible for my 10 years in trauma medicine after working with him for 2 months. And this was the big study that came out in 2003, 2004, forget when. And essentially what it showed was that when you put these bundles together, and this was again looking at catheter-associated bloodstream infections, and that when you pull these bundles together, and have a unified mechanism, in this case using hand washing, that should be a duh, but I will say this, that 30% of physicians and nurses wash their hands on a regular basis. I know you missed that, so let me repeat it. 30% of physicians wash their hands pre and post seeing patients. Now I know here, all of you, it's 100%, because I could see the big thought bubble going over all of your heads right now saying, not me, so good. So hand washing, which again, it's still, I'm blown away by it. I did notice in one of your slides, you had one of the residents or doctors examining a patient that had gloves on. So I liked that, so I appreciated that. So hand washing using full barrier precautions, cleaning the skin with chlorhexidine, avoiding the femoral sites, and removing unnecessary catheters. This was the study that started the whole bundle craze again, and showed these remarkable outcomes leading up to 18 months and beyond. The study's been replicated multiple times. So when we think about our CLABSIs, the central line associated bloodstream infections, you'll see the various gram-positive coccis, your coag-negative staphs, and your gram-negative rods. Don't always blow off a coag-negative staph, and we'll talk about that in a moment. Remove lines as soon as possible. Try to give line holidays, antibiotic locks, and then pick versus midlines. I always try to get a midline whenever possible. Quick study here, just looking at subclavian and showing that subclavians have a less infectious potential than femoral, obvious reasons, and jugular. In this study, this showed that the jugular had more infectious complications, which was a little surprising to me. But unfortunately, with subclavians, for obvious reasons, you're going to have more complications in the form of pneumothoraces. So subacute infections happen about a week after, and again, as I mentioned to you, you're looking mostly at C. diff-associated infections. Here's another clinical vignette, but I'm going to skip through the as a result of time. Non-infectious causes or etiologies for postoperative fevers. The list here, again, inflammation is important, gout is important. I had a guy who was in the ICU about a week ago. We couldn't figure out his fever. I finally did a full head-to-toe again, and I missed the big tophaceous gout that he had that was red and tender, and started him on indomethacin, and he got better immediately. There was we found no source of infection for him. We were able to stop antibiotics. Pancreatitis, I always check an amylase lipase. That's just my standard go-to, just because you'll be amazed at how many you'll pick up along the way. Fat embolism, depending on the operative procedure, cardiovascular and strokes can occur and do every so often. And then, of course, your neuroleptic malignant syndrome that can occur as a result of possible exposure to antipsychotic agents like Haldol. This was a case study here that we saw of a patient, and essentially this was a guy who basically had gout. He had an operative procedure, had gout. My colleague actually cited this study that I'm listing here that had a 15% incidence of gouty attacks after a surgical procedure, and this was a patient, again, this was not the same patient I saw, this was another patient that a colleague saw, was treated for gout after his operative procedure and got better. So real quickly, I'm just going to kind of scan through just various operative procedures here and talk about what some of the basic things you need to think about. Anytime abdominal surgery, of course, the first thing I usually do is try to scan their abdomen as much as possible. Oftentimes, I will, if a surgeon knows that there was a complication, they'll bring us on board early. We'll start antibiotics. We'll scan them. They'll be scan negative, but they're still spiking fevers. Their platelets will keep going up, which is sometimes can be used as an indicator for abscesses. And basically, what we're seeing, we'll rescan about 5 or 6 days later, and you'll see that abscess form at that point. It just took a while for the abscess formation to occur. Gram-negative rods, and of course, anaerobes. Oftentimes, if a patient's gut has been manipulated, I will oftentimes just start coverage for yeast as well, and I'll keep that coverage for yeast in the form of fluconazole or micafungin for five days and until their cultures are negative. Cardiothoracic surgeries are oftentimes normal. A fever after cardiothoracic surgery is normal as a result of a tissue injury, but because you're in the chest, oftentimes pneumonias can be somewhat common, so please have a look out for pneumonias. When it comes to neurosurgery, in some of the readings that I did, meningitis was a frequent and serious cause of fever after neurosurgery. In the last 10 years or so, I have not seen much in the form of meningitis post-neurosurgery, but certainly brain bleeds are a huge cause of central fever. In one of the hospitals I'm at, they have a very active neurosurgery and stroke service. And again, I would say about 95% of all fevers that I've seen on that service that were not infectious were all central fevers. And this has been nice, as it allows me to discontinue antibiotics. Orthopedic surgeries, obviously, gram-positives are somewhat common. Again, when you're looking at prostheses, please don't blow off your coag-negative staffs. Take them seriously. I end up taking care of them about 6 months later. When I look back through the chart, I see that there was a coag-negative staff that appeared that somebody blew off. Urologic surgeries, of course, your gram-negative rods. You're not going to see it so much in a UA, per se, especially when you're dealing with prosthetic processes or perinephric abscesses. So imaging is the best way to determine. Again, your UA is not going to show it, so you would need to rely on your imaging. Sternal wound infections and mediastinitis, a bacteremia with Staph aureus will oftentimes give you a hint, because what you're looking at the surface doesn't necessarily always reflect what's on the bottom end of the sternum that you can't see. So blood cultures that are positive for Staph aureus are somewhat helpful in identifying a mediastinitis. Obviously, we were talking about blood glucose earlier. Poor glucose control is also a risk factor for infection. Vascular surgery, any infections that you're seeing at the inguinal or upper leg sites are ripe for potential infectious complications. Of course, there you're going to be seeing your gram-negative rods and gram-positives. Obstetric surgeries are somewhat also problematic in the form of either UTIs, cellulitises, necrotizing fasciitis, or superficial or deep abscesses, or pelvic thrombophlebitis, and so something to be looking out for. Also being able to distinguish between an abscess, hematoma, and benign fluid collection, which can sometimes be somewhat confusing, but also trigger inflammatory responses in the form of IL-6 as well. This is a case study looking at a female postoperatively, there was really not much there. Just right at time. My summary here is really not every postoperative fever is infectious in nature. Look for symptoms when you're making a diagnosis of HAP, HCAP, and VAP as well. You'll find them. If there's no symptoms that you can see, the patient probably does not, that infiltrate on x-ray does not reflect an infectious complication. Watch for your dirty UAs in evaluating a UTI and a cowdy, insist on a new one if it's dirty. Change your lines early and often. Image your abdomen and pelvis and abdominal procedures. Central fevers and brain bleeds and craniotomies go hand in hand, so be aware of those. And then lastly, don't blow off coagulant-negative staphs, especially when dealing with prosthetic material. Thank you guys very much. I appreciate it. Question, yes. Right, so use of procalcitonin. I work in four hospitals, only one of them we have. I actually tried to bring procalcitonin to Tulane about 5 or 6 years ago. It was really very unsuccessful for us, but one of our Ochsner affiliates now uses procalcitonin, just almost as part of a sepsis guideline like you had mentioned. I find that only in pneumonias have been somewhat helpful, so I'm not a big procalcitonin person, so I haven't used it a whole lot. When it's there, I use it. When it's positive, it's positive. If it's negative, I don't even consider it. And I think that we're at a time where we're not quite for prime time for procalcitonins. They differ from institution to institution. So the ones that they use in Europe are excellent. The studies out of Europe and the brothers, and I forget their names off the top of my head, that are infectious disease doctors in Switzerland, they have amazing experiences of procalcitonin. We have not seen that replicated here in the U.S. So thank you, though. That's a great question.